I'll feel old until spring, and then I'll feel young again. It's that way every year. Are you sure you'll be all right, Ben?
I'll be fine.
Yes, I suppose you will. You're a good boy, Ben.
He looked back at his toes, blushing, loving her more than ever. In the hallway, Mr. Fazio said, "Be careful of defrostbite, boy," without looking up from his red sawdust.
"I will."
He reached his locker, opened it, and yanked on his snow pants. He had been painfully unhappy when his mother insisted he wear them again this winter on especially cold days, thinking of them as baby clothes, but he was glad to have them this afternoon. He walked slowly toward the door, zipping his coat, yanking the drawstrings of his hood tight, pulling on his mittens. He went out and stood on the snow-packed top step of the front stairs for a moment, listening as the door snicked closed and locked behind him. Derry School brooded under a bruised skin of a sky. The wind blew steadily. The snap hooks on the flagpole rope rattled a lonesome tattoo against the steel pole itself. That wind cut into the warm and unprepared flesh of Ben's face at once, numbing his cheeks. "Be careful of the frostbite, boy." He quickly pulled his scarf up until he looked like a small, pudgy caricature of Red Ryder. That darkening sky had a fantastical sort of beauty, but Ben did not pause to admire it. It was too cold for that. He got going. At first the wind was at his back, and things didn't seem so bad. In fact, it actually seemed to be helping him along. At Canal Street, however, he had to turn right and almost fully into the wind. Now it seemed to be holding him back, as if it had business with him. His scarf helped a little, but not enough. His eyes throbbed, and the moisture in his nose froze to a cracked glaze. His legs were going numb. Several times he stuck his mittened hands into his armpits to warm them up. The wind whooped and screamed, sometimes sounding almost human. Ben felt both frightened and exhilarated. Frightened because he could now understand stories he had read, such as Jack London's To Build a Fire, where people actually froze to death. It would be all too possible to freeze to death on a night like this, a night when the temperature would drop to 15 below. The exhilaration was hard to explain. It was a lonely feeling, a somehow melancholy feeling. He was outside. He passed on the wings of the wind, and none of the people beyond the brightly lighted squares of their windows saw him. They were inside, inside, where there was light and warmth. They didn't know he had passed them. Only he knew. It was a secret thing. The moving air burned like needles, but it was fresh and clean. White smoke jetted from his nose in neat little streams. And as sundown came, the last of the day, a cold, yellowy-orange line on the western horizon, the first stars, cruel diamond chips glimmering in the sky overhead, he came to the canal. He was only 3 blocks from home now, and eager to feel the heat on his face and legs, moving the blood again, making it tingle. Still, he paused. The canal was frozen in its concrete sluice like a frozen river of rose milk, its surface humped and cracked and cloudy. It was moveless, yet completely alive in this harshly puritanical winter light. It had its own unique and difficult beauty. Ben turned the other way, southwest, toward the barrens. When he looked in this direction, the wind was at his back again. It made his snow pants ripple and flap. The canal ran straight between its concrete walls for perhaps half a mile. Then the concrete was gone and the river sprawled its way into the barrens, at this time of the year a skeletal world of icy brambles and jutting naked branches. A figure was standing on the ice down there. Ben stared at it and thought, there may be a man down there, but can he be wearing what it looks like he's wearing? It's impossible, isn't it? The figure was dressed in what appeared to be a white silver clown suit. It rippled around him in the polar wind. There were oversized orange shoes on his feet. They matched the pom-pom buttons which ran down the front of his suit. One hand grasped a bundle of strings which rose to a bright bunch of balloons, and when Ben observed that the balloons were floating in his direction, he felt unreality wash over him more strongly. He closed his eyes, rubbed them, opened them. The balloons still appeared to be floating toward him. He heard Mr. Fazio's voice in his head. Be careful of the frostbite, boy. It had to be a hallucination or a mirage brought on by some weird trick of the weather. There could be a man down there on the ice. He supposed it was even technically possible he could be wearing a clown suit. But the balloons couldn't be floating toward Ben into the wind. Yet that was just what they appeared to be doing.
Ben,
the clown on the ice called. Ben thought that voice was only in his mind, although it seemed he heard it with his ears.
Want a balloon, Ben?
There was something so evil in that voice, so awful, that Ben wanted to run away as fast as he could, but his feet seemed as welded to this sidewalk as the teeter-totters in the schoolyard were welded to the ground.
They float, Ben. They all float. Try one and see.
The clown began walking along the ice toward the canal bridge where Ben stood. Ben watched him come, not moving. He watched as a bird watches an approaching snake. The balloon should have burst in the intense cold, but they did not. They floated above and ahead of the clown when they should have been streaming out behind him, trying to escape back into the barrens, where some part of Ben's mind assured him this creature had come from in the first place. Now Ben noticed something else. Although the last of the daylight had struck a rosy glow across the ice of the canal, the clown cast no shadow. None at all.
You like it here, Ben,
the clown said. Now it was close enough so Ben could hear the clud-clud sound its funny shoes made as they advanced over the uneven ice.
You'll like it here, I promise. All the boys and girls I meet like it here, because it's like Pleasure Island in Pinocchio and Never Never Land in Peter Pan. They never have to grow up, and that's what all the kiddies want. So come on, see the sights, have a balloon, feed the elephants, ride the shoot the shoots. Oh, you'll like it. And oh, Ben, how you'll float.
And in spite of his fear, Ben found that part of him did want a balloon. Who in all the world owned a balloon which would float into the wind? Who had even heard of such a thing? Yes, he wanted a balloon, and he wanted to see the clown's face, which was bent down toward the ice, as if to keep it out of that killer wind. What might have happened if the 5 o'clock whistle atop the dairy town hall hadn't blown just then, Ben didn't know. Didn't want to know. The important thing was that it did blow, an ice pick of sound drilling into the deep winter cold. The clown looked up as if startled, and Ben saw its face.
The mummy! Oh my God, it's the mummy!
Was his first thought, accompanied by a swoony horror that caused him to clamp his hands down viciously on the bridge's railing to keep from fainting. Of course it hadn't been the mummy. Couldn't have been the mummy. Oh, there were Egyptian mummies, plenty of them, he knew that. But his first thought had been that it was the mummy, the dusty monster played by Boris Karloff in the old movie he had stayed up late to watch just last month on Shock Theater. No, it wasn't that mummy. Couldn't be. Movie monsters weren't real. Everyone knew that, even little kids, but it wasn't makeup the clown was wearing. Nor was the clown simply swaddled in a bunch of bandages. There were bandages, most of them around its neck and wrists, blowing back in the wind. But Ben could see the clown's face clearly. It was deeply lined, the skin a parchment map of wrinkles, tattered cheeks, arid flesh. The skin of its forehead was split but bloodless. Dead lips grinned back from a maw in which teeth leaned like tombstones. Its gums were pitted and black. Ben could see no eyes, but something glittered far back in the charcoal pits of those puckered sockets. Something like the cold jewels in the eyes of Egyptian scarab beetles. And although the wind was the wrong way, it seemed to him that he could smell cinnamon and spice. Rotting cerements treated with weird drugs, sand, blood so old it had dried to flakes, and grains of rust.
We all float down here, the mummy clown croaked.
And Ben realized with fresh horror that somehow it had reached the bridge. It was now just below him, reaching up with a dry and twisted hand from which flaps of skin rustled like pennons, a hand through which bone like yellow ivory showed. One almost fleshless finger caressed the tip of his boot. Ben's paralysis broke. He pounded the rest of the way across the bridge with the 5 o'clock whistle still shrieking in his ears. It only ceased as he reached the far side. It had to be a mirage. Had to be. The clown simply could not have come so far during the whistle's 10 or 15 second blast. But his fear was not a mirage. Neither were the hot tears which spurted from his eyes and froze on his cheeks a second after being shed. He ran, boots thudding on the sidewalk, and behind him he could hear the mummy in the clown suit climbing up from the canal, ancient stony fingernails scraping across iron, old tendons creaking like dry hinges. He could hear the arid whistle of its breath pulling in and pushing out of nostrils as devoid of moisture as the tunnels under the Great Pyramid. He could smell its shroud of sandy spices, and he knew that in a moment its hands, as fleshless as the geometrical constructions he made with his erector set, would descend upon his shoulders. They would turn him around, and he would stare into that wrinkled, smiling face. The dead river of its breath would wash over him. Those black eye sockets with their deep, glowing depths would bend over him. The toothless mouth would yawn, and he would have his balloon. Oh, yes. All the balloons he wanted. But when he reached the corner of his own street, sobbing and winded, his heart slamming crazed, leaping beats into his ears, when he at last looked back over his shoulder, the street was empty. The arched bridge with its low concrete sides and its old-fashioned cobblestone paving was also empty. He could not see the canal itself, but he felt that if he could, he would see nothing there either. No. If the mummy had not been a hallucination or a mirage, if it had been real, it would be waiting under the bridge, like the troll in the story of the Three Billy Goats Gruff. Under. Hiding under. Ben hurried home, looking back every few steps until the door was safely shut and locked behind him. He explained to his mother, who was so tired from a particularly hard day at the mill that she had not, in truth, much missed him, that he had been helping Mrs. Douglas count books. Then he sat down to a dinner of noodles and Sunday's leftover turkey. He stuffed three helpings into himself, and the mummy seemed more distant and dreamlike with each helping. It was not real. Those things were never real. They came fully to life only between the commercials of the late-night TV movies or during the Saturday matinees, where if you were lucky, you could get two monsters for a quarter. And if you had an extra quarter, you could buy all the popcorn you could eat. No, they were not real. TV monsters and movie monsters and comic book monsters were not real. Not until you went to bed and couldn't sleep. Not until the last four pieces of candy, wrapped in tissues and kept under your pillow against the evils of the night, were gobbled up. Not until the bed itself turned into a lake of rancid dreams and the wind screamed outside and you were afraid to look at the window because there might be a face there. An ancient grinning face that had not rotted but simply dried like an old leaf, its eyes sunken diamonds pushed deep into dark sockets. Not until you saw one ripped and claw-like hand holding out a bunch of balloons.
See the sights, have a balloon, feed the elephants, ride the shoot the shoots. Ben, oh Ben, how you float.
12. Ben awoke with a gasp, the dream of the mummy still on him, panicked by the close, vibrating dark all around him. He jerked, and the root stopped supporting him and poked him in the back again, as if in exasperation. He saw light and scrambled for it. He crawled out into the afternoon sunlight and the babble of the stream, and everything fell into place again. It was summer, not winter. The mummy had not carried him away to its desert crypt. Ben had simply hidden from the big kids in a sandy hole under a half-uprooted tree. He was in the barrens. Henry and his buddies had gone to town in a small way on a couple of kids playing downstream because they hadn't been able to find Ben and go to town on him in a big way. Ta-ta, boys. It was a real baby dam, believe me. You're better off without it. Ben looked glumly down at his ruined clothes. His mother was going to give him 16 different flavors of holy old hell. He had slept just long enough to stiffen up. He slid down the embankment and then began to walk along the stream, wincing at every step. He was a medley of aches and pains. It felt like Spike Jones was playing a fast tune on broken glass inside most of his muscles. There seemed to be dried or drying blood on every inch of exposed skin. The dam-building kids would be gone anyway, he consoled himself. He wasn't sure how long he'd slept, but even if it had only been half an hour, The encounter with Henry and his friends would have convinced Denbro and his pal that some other place, like Timbuktu maybe, would be better for their health. Ben plugged grimly along, knowing if the big kids came back now, he would not stand a chance of outrunning them. He hardly cared. He rounded an elbow bend in the stream and just stood there for a moment, looking. The dam builders were still there. One of them was indeed stuttering Bill Denbro. He was kneeling beside the other boy, who was propped against the stream bank in a sitting position. This other kid's head was thrown so far back that his Adam's apple stood out like a triangular plug. There was dried blood around his nose, on his chin, and painted along his neck in a couple of streams. He had something white clasped loosely in one hand. Stuttering Bill looked around sharply and saw Ben standing there. Ben saw with dismay that something was very wrong with the boy propped up on the bank. Denbro was obviously scared to death. He thought miserably, won't this day ever end?
I wonder if maybe you could help me, Bill Denbro said. His aspirator is empty. I think he might be.
His face froze, turned red. He dug at the word, stuttering like a machine gun. Spittle flew from his lips, and it took almost 30 seconds worth of da-da-da-da before Ben realized Denbro was trying to say the other kid might be dying. Chapter 5 Bill Denbro Beats the Devil, 1. 1. Bill Denbro thinks, I'm damn near space traveling. I might as well be inside a bullet shot from a gun. This thought, although perfectly true, is not one he finds especially comfortable. In fact, for the first hour following the Concorde's takeoff, or perhaps liftoff would be a better way to put it, from Heathrow, he has been coping with a mild case of claustrophobia. The airplane is narrow, unsettlingly so. The meal is just short of exquisite, but the flight attendants who serve it must twist and bend and squat to get the job done. They look like a troop of gymnasts. Watching this strenuous service takes some of the pleasure out of the food for Bill, although his seatmate doesn't seem particularly bothered. The seatmate is another drawback. He's fat and not particularly clean. It may be Ted Lapidus' cologne on top of his skin, but beneath it, Bill detects the unmistakable odors of dirt and sweat. He's not being very particular about his left elbow, either. Every now and then it strikes Bill with a soft thud. His eyes are drawn again and again to the digital readout at the front of the cabin. It shows how fast this British bullet is going. Now, as the Concorde reaches its cruising speed, it tops out at just over Mach 2. Bill takes his pen from his shirt pocket and uses its tip to tap buttons on the computer watch Audra gave him last Christmas. If the machometer is right, and Bill has absolutely no reason to think it is not, then they are busting along at a speed of 18 miles per minute. He is not sure this is anything he really wanted to know. Outside his window, which is as small and thick as the window in one of the old Mercury space capsules, he can see a sky which is not blue, but the twilight purple of dusk, although it is the middle of the day. At the point where the sea and the sky meet, he can see that the horizon line is slightly bowed. I am sitting here, Bill thinks, a Bloody Mary in my hand and a dirty fat man's elbow poking into my bicep, observing the curvature of the earth. He smiles a little, thinking that a man who can face something like that shouldn't be afraid of anything. But he is afraid, and not just of flying at 18 miles a minute in this narrow, fragile shell. He can almost feel Derry rushing at him, and that is exactly the right expression for it. 18 miles a minute or not, the sensation of being perfectly still while Derry rushes at him like some big carnivore which has lain in wait for a long time and has finally broken from cover. Derry. Ah, Derry. Shall we write an ode to Derry? The stink of its mills and its rivers, the dignified quiet of its tree-lined streets, the library, the standpipe, Basie Park, Derry Elementary School, the Barrens. Lights are going on in his head, big Kleegs. It's like he's been sitting in a darkened theater for 27 years, waiting for something to happen, and now it's finally begun. The set being revealed spot by spot and Klieg by Klieg is not, however, some harmless comedy like Arsenic and Old Lace. To Bill Denbro, it looks more like the cabinet of Dr. Caligari. All those stories I wrote, he thinks with a stupid kind of amusement. All those novels. Derry is where they all came from. Derry was the wellspring. They came from what happened that summer, and from what happened to George the autumn before. All the interviewers that ever asked me that question, I gave them the wrong answer. The fat man's elbow digs into him again, and he spills some of his drink. Bill almost says something, then thinks better of it. That question, of course, was, where do you get your ideas? It was a question Bill supposed all writers of fiction had to answer, or pretend to answer, at least twice a week. But a fellow like him, who made a living by writing of things which never were and never could be, had to answer it, or pretend to, much more often than that. All writers have a pipeline which goes down into the subconscious, he told them, neglecting to mention that he doubted more as each year passed if there even was such a thing as a subconscious. But the man or woman who writes horror stories has a pipeline that goes further, maybe, into the sub-subconscious, if you like. Elegant answer that, but one he had never really believed. Subconscious? Well, there was something down there, all right, but Bill thought people had made much too big a deal out of a function which was probably the mental equivalent of your eyes watering when dust got in them, or breaking wind an hour or so after a big dinner. The second metaphor was probably the better of the two, but you couldn't very well tell interviewers that, as far as you were concerned, such things as dreams and vague longings and sensations like déjà vu really came down to nothing more than a bunch of mental farts. But they seemed to need something. All those reporters with their notebooks and their little Japanese tape recorders. And Bill wanted to help them as much as he could. He knew that writing was a hard job, a damned hard job. There was no need to make theirs harder by telling them, "My friend, you might as well ask me who cut the cheese and have done with it." He thought now, you always knew they were asking the wrong question even before Mike called. Now you also know what the right question was. Not where do you get your ideas, but why do you get your ideas? There was a pipeline, all right, but it wasn't either the Freudian or Jungian version of the subconscious that it came out of. No interior drain system of the mind, no subterranean cavern full of Morlocks waiting to happen. There was nothing at the other end of that pipe but Derry. Just Derry. And who's that trip-trapping upon my bridge? He sits bolt upright suddenly, and this time it's his elbow that goes wandering. It sinks deeply into his fat seatmate's side for a moment. Watch yourself, buddy, the fat man says. Close quarters, you know. You stop whapping me with yours, and I'll try to stop whapping you with mine. The fat man gives him a sour, incredulous, what the hell you talking about look. Bill simply gazes at him until the fat man looks away, muttering. Who's there? Who's trip-trapping over my bridge? He looks out the window again and thinks. We're beating the devil. His arms and the nape of his neck prickle. He knocks back the rest of his drink in one swallow. Another of those big lights has gone on. Silver, his bike. That was what he had called it, after the Lone Ranger's horse. A big Schwinn, 28 inches tall. You'll kill yourself on that, Billy, his father had said, but with no real concern in his tone. He had shown little concern for anything since George's death. Before, he had been tough, fair but tough. Since, you could get around him. He would make fatherly gestures, go through fatherly motions, but motions and gestures were all they were. It was like he was always listening for George to come back into the house. Bill had seen it in the window of the bike and cycle shop down on Center Street. It leaned gloomily on its kickstand, bigger than the biggest of the others on display. Dull where they were shiny, straight in places where the others were curved, bent in places where the others were straight. Propped on its front tire had been a sign. Used. Make an offer. What actually happened was that Bill went in and the owner made him an offer, which Bill took. He wouldn't have known how to dicker with the cycle shop owner if his life depended on it. And the price, $24, the man quoted seemed very fair to Bill, generous even. He paid for silver with money he had saved up over the last 7 or 8 months. Birthday money, Christmas money, lawn mowing money. He had been noticing the bike in the window ever since Thanksgiving. He paid for it and wheeled it home as soon as the snow began to melt for good. It was funny because he'd never thought much about owning a bike before last year. The idea seemed to come into his mind all at once. Perhaps on one of those endless days after George died, was murdered. In the beginning, Bill almost did kill himself. The first ride on his new bike ended with Bill dumping it on purpose to keep from running smack into the board fence at the end of Kossuth Lane. He had not been so afraid of running into the fence as he had been of bashing right through it and falling 60 feet into the barrens. He came away from that one with a 5-inch gash running between the wrist and elbow of his left arm. Not even a week later, he had found himself unable to brake soon enough and had shot through the intersection of Witcham and Jackson at perhaps 35 miles an hour, a little kid on a dusty gray mastodon of a bike. Silver was silver only by the most energetic reach of a willing imagination. Playing cards machine gunning the spokes of the front and back wheels in a steady roar, and if a car had been coming, he would have been dead meat, just like Georgie. He got control of Silver little by little as the spring advanced. Neither of his parents noticed during that time that he was courting death by bicycle. He thought that, after the first few days, they had ceased to really see his bike at all. To them, it was just a relic with chipped paint which leaned against the garage wall on rainy days. Silver was a lot more than some dusty old relic, though. He didn't look like much, but he went like the wind. Bill's friend, his only real friend, was a kid named Eddie Kasprak. And Eddie was good with mechanical things. He had shown Bill how to get Silver in shape, which bolts to tighten and check regularly, where to oil the sprockets, how to tighten the chain, how to put on a bike patch so it would stay if you got a flat. "You ought to paint it," he remembered Eddie saying one day. But Bill didn't want to paint Silver. For reasons he couldn't even explain to himself, he wanted the Schwinn just the way it was. It looked like a real bow wow, the sort of bike a careless kid regularly left out on his lawn in the rain. A bike that would be all squeaks and shudders and slow friction. It looked like a bow wow, but it went like the wind. It would beat the devil, he says aloud and laughs. His fat seatmate looks at him sharply. The laugh has that howling quality that gave Audra the creeps earlier. Yes, it looked pretty shoddy, with its old paint and the old-fashioned package carrier mounted above the back wheel and the ancient Uga horn with its black rubber bulb. That horn was permanently welded to the handlebars with a rusty bolt the size of a baby's fist. Pretty shoddy. But could Silver go? Could he? Christ. And it was a damn good thing he could, because Silver had saved Bill Denbrough's life in the fourth week of June, 1958. The week after he met Ben Hanscom for the first time. The week after he and Ben and Eddie built the dam. The week that Ben and Richie Trashmouth Tozier and Beverly Marsh showed up in the Barrens after the Saturday matinee. Richie had been riding behind him on Silver's package carrier the day Silver had saved Bill's life. So he supposed Silver had saved Richie's, too. And he remembered the house they had been running from, all right. He remembered that just fine. That damned house on Niebolt Street. He had raced to beat the devil that day. Oh, yeah, for sure. Don't you just know it? Some devil with eyes as shiny as old deadly coins. Some hairy old devil with a mouth full of bloody teeth. But all that had come later. If Silver had saved Richie's life and his own that day, then perhaps he had saved Eddie Kasprak's on the day Bill and Eddie met Ben by the kicked-apart remains of their dam in the Barrens. Henry Bowers, who looked a little bit like someone had run him through a disposal, had mashed Eddie's nose and then Eddie's asthma had come on strong and his aspirator turned up empty. So it had been Silver that day, too. Silver to the rescue. Bill Denbrough, who hasn't been on a bicycle in almost 17 years, looks out the window of an airplane that would not have been credited, or even imagined, outside of a science fiction magazine in the year 1958.
Hi-yo, Silver, away, he thinks, and has to close his eyes against the sudden needling sting of tears. What happened to Silver?
He can't remember. That part of the set is still dark. That Klieg has yet to be turned on. Perhaps that is just as well. Perhaps that is a mercy. Hi-yo. Hi-yo, Silver. Hi-yo, Silver.
2.
Away, he shouted. The wind tore the words back over his shoulder like a fluttering crepe streamer. They came out big and strong, those words, in a triumphant roar. They were the only ones that ever did. He pedaled down Kansas Street toward town, gaining speed slowly at first. Silver rolled once he got going, but getting going was a job and a half. Watching the gray bike pick up speed was a little like watching a big plane roll down the runway. At first, you couldn't believe such a huge waddling gadget could ever actually leave the earth. The idea was absurd. But then you could see its shadow beneath it, and before you even had time to wonder if it was a mirage, the shadow was trailing out long behind it, and the plane was up, cutting its way through the air, as sleek and graceful as a dream in a satisfied mind. Silver was like that. Bill got a little downhill stretch and began to pedal faster, his legs pumping up and down as he stood forward over the bike's fork. He had learned very quickly, after being bashed a couple of times by that fork in the worst place a boy can be bashed, to yank his underpants up as high as he could before mounting Silver. Later that summer, observing this process, Richie would say, "Bill does that because he thinks he might like to have some kids that live someday. It seems like a bad idea to me, but hey, they might always take after his wife, right?" He and Eddie had lowered the seat as far as it would go, and it now bumped and scraped against the small of his back as he worked the pedals. A woman digging weeds in her flower garden shaded her eyes to watch him pass. She smiled a little. The boy in the huge bike reminded her of a monkey she had once seen riding a unicycle in the Barnum and Bailey Circus. "He's apt to kill himself, though," she thought, turning back to her garden. "That bike is too big for him." It was none of her problem, though.
3.
Bill had had more sense than to argue with the big boys when they broke out of the bushes, looking like ill-tempered hunters on the track of a beast which had already mauled one of them. Eddie, however, had rashly opened his mouth and Henry Bowers had unloaded on him. Bill knew who they were, all right. Henry, Belch, and Victor were just about the worst kids in Derry School. They had beaten up on Richie Tozier, who Bill sometimes chummed with, a couple of times. The way Bill looked at it, this was partly Richie's own fault. He was not known as Trash Mouth for nothing. One day in April, Richie had said something about their collars as the three of them passed by in the schoolyard. The collars had all been turned up, just like Vic Morrow's and the Blackboard Jungle. Bill, who had been sitting against the building nearby and listlessly shooting a few marbles, hadn't really caught all of it. Neither did Henry and his friends, but they heard enough to turn in Richie's direction. Bill supposed Richie had meant to say whatever he said in a low voice. The trouble was, Richie didn't really have a low voice.
"What did you say, you little four-eyes geek?" Victor Chris inquired.
"I didn't say nothing," Richie said, and that disclaimer, along with his face, which looked quite sensibly dismayed and scared, might have ended it. Except that Richie's mouth was like a half-tamed horse that has a way of bolting for absolutely no reason at all. Now it suddenly added, "You ought to dig the wax out of your ears, big fella. Want some blasting powder?"
They stood looking at him incredulously for a moment, and then they took after him. Stuttering Bill had watched the unequal race from its start to its preordained conclusion from his place against the side of the building. No sense getting involved. Those three galoots would be just as happy to beat up on two kids for the price of one. Richie ran diagonally across the little kid's play yard, leaping over the teeter-totters and dodging among the swings, realizing he had run into a blind alley only when he struck the chain-link fence between the play yard and the park which abutted the school grounds. So he tried to go up the chain link, all clutching fingers and pointing, seeking sneaker toes, and he was maybe two-thirds of the way to the top when Henry and Victor Chris hauled him back down again, Henry getting him by the back of the jacket and Victor grabbing the seat of his jeans. Richie was screaming when they peeled him off the fence. He hit the asphalt on his back. His glasses flew off. He reached for them, and Belch Huggins kicked them away, and that was why one of the bows was mended with adhesive tape this summer. Bill had winced and walked around to the front of the building. He had observed Mrs. Moran, one of the fourth-grade teachers, already hurrying over to break things up. But he knew they would get Richie hard before then, and by the time she actually arrived, Richie would be crying.
Ball baby, look at the baby ball.
Bill had only minor problems with them. They made fun of his stutter, of course. An occasional random cruelty came with the jibes. One rainy day, as they were going to lunch in the gym, Belch Huggins had knocked Bill's lunch bag out of his hand and had stomped it flat with one engineer boot, squishing everything inside.
"Oh, ja-ja-gee,"
Belch cried in mock horror, raising his hands and fluttering them about his face.
"Sorry about your little lunch, fa-ha-ha-huck face."
And he had strolled off down the hall toward where Victor Chris was leaning against the drinking fountain outside the boys' room door, just about laughing himself into a hernia. That hadn't been so bad, though. Bill had cadged half a PB&J off Eddie Kasprak, and Richie was happy to give him his deviled egg, one of which his mother packed in his lunch about every second day and which made him want to puke, he claimed. But you had to stay out of their way, and if you couldn't do that, you had to try and be invisible. Eddie forgot the rules, so they creamed him. He hadn't been too bad until the big boys went downstream and splashed across to the other side, even though his nose was bleeding like a fountain. When Eddie's snot rag was soaked through, Bill had given him his own and made him put a hand on the nape of his neck and lean his head back. Bill could remember his mother getting Georgie to do that, because Georgie sometimes got nosebleeds. Oh, but it hurt to think about George. It wasn't until the sound of the big boy's buffalo-like progress through the barrens had died away completely, and Eddie's nosebleed had actually stopped, that his asthma got bad. He started heaving for air, his hands opening and then snapping shut like weak traps, his respiration a fluting whistle in his throat.
"Shit," Eddie gasped. "Asthma. Cripes."
He scrambled for his aspirator and finally got it out of his pocket. It looked almost like a bottle of Windex, the kind with the sprayer attachment on top. He jammed it into his mouth and punched the trigger.
"Better?" Bill said anxiously.
"No, it's empty."
Eddie looked at Bill with panicked eyes that said, "I'm caught, Bill, I'm caught." The empty aspirator rolled away from his hand. The stream chuckled on, not caring in the least that Eddie Kasprak could barely breathe. Bill thought randomly that the big boys had been right about one thing. It had been a real baby dam. But they had been having fun, damn it, and he felt a sudden dull fury that it should have to come to this.
Take it easy, Eddie, he said.
For the next 40 minutes or so, Bill sat next to him. His expectation that Eddie's asthma attack would at any moment let up, gradually fading into unease. By the time Ben Hanscom appeared, the unease had become real fear. It not only wasn't letting up, it was getting worse. And the Center Street drug, where Eddie got his refills, was 3 miles away, almost. What if he went to get Eddie's stuff and came back to find Eddie unconscious? Unconscious or... Don't shit, please don't think that. Or even dead, his mind insisted implacably. Like Georgie, dead like Georgie. Don't be such an asshole. He's not going to die. No, probably not. But what if he came back and found Eddie in a coma? Bill knew all about comers. He had even deduced they were named after those great big waves guys surfed on in Hawaii. And that seemed right enough. After all, what was a comer but a wave that drowned your brain? On doctor shows like Ben Casey, people were always going into comers. And sometimes they stayed there in spite of all Ben Casey's ill-tempered shouting. So he sat there, knowing he ought to go. He couldn't do Eddie any good staying here, but not wanting to leave him alone. An irrational, superstitious part of him felt sure Eddie would slip into a coma the minute he, Bill, turned his back. Then he looked upstream and saw Ben Hanscom standing there. He knew who Ben was, of course. The fattest kid in any school has his or her own sort of unhappy notoriety. Ben was in the other fifth grade. Bill sometimes saw him at recess, standing by himself, usually in a corner, looking at a book and eating his lunch out of a bag about the size of a laundry sack. Looking at Ben now, Bill thought he looked even worse than Henry Bowers. It was hard to believe, but true. Bill could not begin to imagine the cataclysmic fight these two must have been in. Ben's hair stood up in wild, dirt-clotted spikes. His sweater, or sweatshirt, it was hard to tell which it had started the day as, and it sure as shit didn't matter now, was a matted ruin, smeared with a sicko mixture of blood and grass. His pants were out at the knees. He saw Bill looking at him and recoiled a bit, eyes going wary.
Did-da-da-hunk-g-g-go,
Bill cried. He put his empty hands up in the air, palms out, to show he was harmless.
We need some help.
Ben came closer, eyes still wary. He walked as if one or both of his legs was killing him.
Are they gone? Bowers and those guys?
Yes,
Bill said.
Listen, Cahen, you stay with my friend while I go get his medicine? He's got asthma?
Bill nodded. Ben came all the way down to the remains of the dam and dropped painfully to one knee beside Eddie, who was lying back with his eyes mostly closed and his chest heaving.
Which one hit him?
Ben asked finally. He looked up, and Bill saw the same frustrated anger he had been feeling himself on the fat kid's face.
Was it Henry Bowers?
Bill nodded.
It figures. Sure, go on. I'll stay with him. That's the Hanks.
Oh, don't thank me, Ben said. I'm the reason they landed on you in the first place.
Go on, hurry it up. I have to be home for supper.
Bill went without saying anything else. It would have been good to tell Ben not to take it to heart. What had happened hadn't been Ben's fault any more than it had been Eddie's for stupidly opening his mouth. Guys like Henry and his buddies were an accident waiting to happen. The little kid's version of floods or tornadoes or gallstones. It would have been good to say that, but he was so tightly wound right now, it would have taken him about 20 minutes or so. And by then, Eddie might have slipped into a coma. That was another thing Bill had learned from Doctors Casey and Kildare. You never went into a coma. You always slipped into one. He trotted downstream, glancing back once. He saw Ben Hanscom grimly collecting rocks from the edge of the water. For a moment, Bill couldn't figure out what he was doing. And then he understood. It was an ammo dump, just in case they came back. 4. The Barrens were no mystery to Bill. He had played here a lot this spring, sometimes with Richie, more frequently with Eddie, sometimes all by himself. He had by no means explored the whole area, but he could find his way back to Kansas Street from the Kanduskeag with no trouble, and now did. He came out at a wooden bridge where Kansas Street crossed one of the little no-name streams that flowed out of the dairy drainage system and into the Kanduskeag down below. Silver was stashed under this bridge, his handlebars tied to one of the bridge supports with a hank of rope to keep his wheels out of the water. Bill untied the rope, stuck it in his shirt, and hauled Silver up to the sidewalk by main force, panting and sweating, losing his balance a couple of times and landing on his tail. But at last it was up. Bill swung his leg over the high fork, and as always, once he was on Silver, he became someone else. End of side 6. To continue, change side selector switch and turn the cassette over.